Okay, welcome to this morning's session, another Q&A session. Hopefully, if people have kept the rules and haven't put any more questions in here, I should be able to finish these this morning. Yeah, good. You've been very good. Uh-oh, some more ones. Are there complaints? I'm not going to read those out. What we do with complaints here is we allow people to actually to put all their complaints into a box. And then at the end of the retreat, we burn them all. Without reading them. Because it's called the fault-finding mind. Because sometimes, no matter how good it is, we can always find fault with it. And sometimes we don't understand what's going on. Is the complaint to do with the retreat? Is the complaint to do with the teachings or the manager? Is the complaint to do with the other people around you? No, the complaints are about you. It's just like Ajahn Chah saying, I mentioned that story yesterday, when a monk was having a hard time, he said, is the monastery suffering or are you suffering? And he had to say, no, it's not the monastery suffering, it's not the monastery's fault, it's my fault. So if you have any complaints, it's your fault. Do you understand? Because a lot of times we have compassion to our fellow yogis. If they make a noise or they cough or they talk, that's their business. Because if they're talking and not keeping noble silence, oh, poor things. They're not going to get nimittas or jhanas if they do things like that. Oh, poor things. So you don't want to upset them even more. They're already going to be disadvantaged by them not keeping their rules. So, poor things. Oh. So you have compassion, you don't have ill will. I'm going to tell them to be quiet. I'm going to complain to the manager. I'm going to complain to Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to... That just makes more problems for you. Ajahn Chah used to say, you look at other people at the most 5% of the time. That's maximum. You look at yourself 95% of the time. Okay, so don't worry about anybody else. Whoever's making any noise, whoever's sleeping, whoever's talking, that's their business. Your business is your mind. So you keep your noble silence inside. Don't worry about other people's silence. You keep your silence. You keep your lack of fault finding. So you can be so compassionate. When you see these people here, some of these people, that's the first retreat they've ever done. And I'm really, really impressed that people have actually sat meditation, have kept their precepts and done so well. I'm so impressed with each one of you. So even anybody here, you know, I always think you've done very, very, very well. Because I don't see the faults in people, I see their successes. Just think the fact that people have given up 9 days to practice in the footsteps of the Buddha. They're keeping 8 precepts. That amount is sadhu, 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 anumodana. That's why they was come. If you weren't worthy of it, they wouldn't come. So each one of you is worthy. So that way you can't have fault finding. Instead you have this wonderful sense of gratitude to your fellow yogis, to this place. Sure, it could be better, but it's good enough. Once you don't complain about the place, you don't complain about your fellow yogis, once you have this beautiful attitude of kindness, acceptance, good enough, then when you look at your mind doesn't keep noble silence either. Yak, 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 yak. The mind sometimes speaks too much. But you see those moments in your mind when you're not sleeping, the moments when you don't talk to yourself, and you think, oh, what a wonderful mind this is. You don't have fault finding, you have gratitude and acceptance of you. And that way you'll find the way to peace. Be careful of the fault finding mind. Once you get into that fault finding mind, you can even find fault with the Buddha. He sits too straight. So, you can always find fault with anything once you have the fault finding mind. So be careful of complaints. They're not valid. They all come from your fault-finding mind. If you can find complaints with the yogis here, this is the creme de la creme of people in Malaysia and Singapore. You are the top of the pile. You can complain about people like this. What are you going to do when you get back home? Oh, so be kind. Okay, the first question here. Dear Ajahn, karma, please explain in greater detail because we are often puzzled by, number one, why Africa blacks are totally in such horrible state of affairs, children, women, weak, sick, are killed daily. Why these innocents are so horribly killed because of their past lives. Why nearly the whole of Africa continent has bad karma. People have bad karma. Can country or even continent have good karma or bad karma? I must have had very bad karma to be born in England. It's a long way from Buddhism. So I think, oh, I must have done something bad. Not to be born in a nice country like Malaysia or Thailand or Burma or somewhere. But it doesn't matter where you're born into. It's what you do with that. And of course, there's some very wonderful black Africans. There's black African monks now. I don't know if there's a, what's it called, the first global conference in Singapore about 4 years ago. Anyone who went there, do you remember? They had some black African monks come and do the Namo Tassa chant. They're wonderful. Because it doesn't matter if you're black on the outside or pink on the outside or yellow with stripes. What's important is what's on the inside. You're a human being. And it's marvelous. You don't judge a person where they came from. You judge them by who they are. So it is true that sometimes that continents have bad karma in the sense that, you know, we do things together. Somebody once asked me about, you know, the Twin Towers. All those people dying together. Why is that? Is there such a thing as group karma? And I said, well, actually, yeah. Because we have, like, people go to war. And a whole regiment, hundreds of soldiers, they all sort of rape and pillage and kill together. And so sometimes they get the fruit of that karma together. You know, individual karma is, yes, that's the most important. Because we do things together, sometimes we reap the fruit of that karma together. So sometimes, and it is because sometimes we people kill in gangs. Or, you know, we sort of we press our governments to do this and to do that. Some of it's good karma, some of it's bad karma. And so that we are responsible in that sense. So in a sense, the groups of people, when you count their karma together, there's such similarity because they did things together in their past, they're doing things together now. So that, yeah, there does seem to be like a group karma there. But the group karma is no more than the sum of the individual parts. So countries and continents, as it were, have good karma and bad karma. We live in a wonderful age now where we can actually move from place to place pretty easily. Okay, it's not so easy for some countries, but if they really try, you know, people can move around. So we can actually sometimes choose our countries now. Sometimes difficult, but we can do that, and it's becoming more and more easy as many of your children study overseas and maybe marry overseas and go live overseas. And it's really great for the old parents, because the old parents, they can spend 2 months in Australia, and they can spend, you know, when it's a nice weather, and they can go 2 months in US when it's nice weather there, then they go to England for 2 months. They don't have to pay any hotel bills. Oh, isn't it wonderful having children in many different countries? And then they can have the children back here in Malaysia and spend 2 months over here. Then you go, well, you don't need a house. Because you stay in your children's houses. All you need is, you know, for your pension enough to get the airfares. Isn't that one? I think that's a great thing to do. But anyway, you can move around. So people or groups of people can have bad karma. Question two. Bush families, two presidents and one governor. According to Chinese belief, their families must have, in the past generations, accumulated so much good karma. But why now do the two presidents of the Bush family seem intending to put the world on fire and the earth to destruction? It's called bushfires. Why? Why good past karma produces bad presidents? It is. Sometimes that happens. The thing is, it's when you have good karma, you get put in positions of power. You know, like, I'm in a position of power now, abbot of the monastery. But I have to be very, very careful. Because when you get in positions of power and authority, it's very easy to abuse those positions of power and authority. You can imagine if you stand up here or sit up here rather than you give all these talks and lots of people come and see you. You have to be very careful, because the Buddha said that for senior monks who become teachers, who have disciples, you've got to be very careful of three things, and that's lava, sakara, saloka. Gains, honors, and fame. Because sometimes that can corrupt even a good monk. So the gains are okay, because I don't keep anything for myself. Now, all the young powers, they go to the monastery, they go somewhere else, I don't get anything out of that. Even my robes, when you become a senior monk, you don't get special lame robes made by Gucci or Versace. You have the same robes as anyone else. And it's part of our tradition that we share everything we have. So I don't get anything special. And I made a resolution when I was a young monk. And I kept that resolution that I will not stay in accommodation, especially my hut, if it's more luxurious than the poorest of my supporters. I use the poorest of my supporters as my standard. And if I'm living better than them, I can't stand it. I'll have to lower my lifestyle. Because these are people who support you. All my food, I don't earn it myself. You bring it to me. The huts are all made from donations. So I would feel a hypocrite if one of my supporters was living in a shack and I lived in a mansion. It didn't seem right to me. So that's the way I try and keep down the gains. You know, my accommodation, my robes, my food. Of course, I've got not much chance with my food. You give me whatever you want. And honor and fame. I'm very fortunate to live with a group of monks. So when you live with lots of other monks, I've encouraged them to argue with me and disagree with me. So all the monks in my monastery, they're not yes monks. Very often they're no monks. They're no, that's wrong. And I have to encourage that, because if I didn't have other monks actually to keep you in line, sometimes you might be afraid that without knowing it, you become proud, you become egocentric, you become, you know, just the great abbot instead of just a simple monk. So here you have to, having other monks around you, it's the power of the Sangha, which the Buddha established. Once you live not just by yourself, but with other monks, and you keep the rules of a monk, because when it comes to decision making, every monk has the same vote. They have one vote, no greater value to the senior monk or the monk just ordained that day. So that takes away the idea of like, honor and fame and power. And the Buddha was not just wise in the Dhamma. The way he set up the sanghas of monks and nuns was absolutely brilliant. That's why it's lasted so long. It's very difficult for a monk, you know, to actually get that degree of power and fame if they keep the rules. So my teacher told us to keep those rules. We do, and that's why we're successful. However, in politics, sometimes I've known politicians, and very many of them, when they start out with the highest of motives. They really want to serve their country or serve their nation. They want to do something good for the world. But unfortunately, when you get into those positions of power, it is, the power corrupts you. When there's no checks and balances, the president, whether it's a Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge or Buddhist Society of West Australia, the president of the United States, whoever the presidents are, if you haven't got those checks and balances, it's too easy to get into power and get into ego. And that's where everything starts to go wrong. Whether you're an abbot or a president or just the head of a family, you are representing all the people, you know, who you serve. You are not the one in charge. You are their servant. The president should be the slave of the American people, not their master. You should be the servant. If you're the president of Champaka Buddhist Lodge or whatever, you should be the servant of all the devotees who come here. It's hard work. The more responsibility you take, it should be the less of a self you have. The more selfless, the more you can handle positions of power. That's why, at least in the Buddhist system, usually by the time you become like an abbot or a teacher, you've abandoned the sense of self so much that because of selflessness, honor and fame don't really touch you. So I think it's the way that we live. Sometimes we think, oh, why don't we get like a monk to be the President of the United States? You wouldn't want to do that at all, because unfortunately that such politicians, it's the system actually, as it were, chooses those who are the most egocentric, the most motivated sometimes, the people who can play dirty sometimes, not always. There's some very wonderful politicians, servants of the community. But that is our life. Unfortunately, when a person does get in a position of power, they start off usually very, very good, and without the checks and balance, too much power, and they slide away. At least with the US system, it's very good. They can only serve 2 terms. If they had more terms than that, they would get more and more corrupt. It's nature. You can't do much about that. It's not Mr. Bush's fault. It's not anyone's fault. It's just the nature of things. It's the Dharma. Too much power, you get too much ego, too much corrupt. Okay, so that's Ajahn Brahm's foray into politics today. Now I'll get back to Dharma. The Heart Sutra always talks about emptiness. No body, feelings, perceptions, etc. All senses disappear. Body, sattva. Avalokiteshvara practices this profound Prajnaparamita and got enlightened. Is this what you're saying about meditation yesterday, getting the first jhana which removes all senses, etc. and got enlightened? How come Sariputta, the Buddha's disciple, got involved here too? I don't know what that means in the end, but involved here too. But all of those disciples did the jhanas. Sariputta did the jhanas as well. The point was that sometimes we can think emptiness, and I gave that story yesterday or a couple of days ago about the monk going to the restaurant, you know, and the the owner of the restaurant giving him a plate of emptiness to eat. Sometimes we can play around with those concepts and ideas, but we only know that we've truly understood these things when it gives peace, happiness, joy, harmony to our lives. So if you have greed and hatred, then you know you cannot be enlightened. Arahats, enlightened beings, never get angry. And if they say, oh, it's no one in here getting angry, it's just anger coming out, but I'm not really angry, there's no one in here, that's just playing games. If there was no one in here, there'd be no one to get angry. If there's no one in here, there'd be no one to have greed or lust. So sometimes that we can get too intellectual with the Dhamma. And that's why there'd be many people write these amazing books. But that's not real Prajnaparamita, and that's not huge wisdom. That's just the thinking wisdom. So we have to be very, very careful. Make sure that it's not just what we think, but what we do. We can tell our wisdom. The sign of wisdom is not that you can write books. The sign of wisdom is not that you can give talks. The sign of wisdom is you can be at peace. No matter what's going on, if your husband or wife says you're stupid, camel face, whatever, you can be so at peace. It doesn't affect you. Now that's the sign of wisdom, the ability to let go, the ability to be at peace, to be serene in even the most adverse of situations. You know you're wise, not if you can recite the Heart Sutra. You know you're wise, as if you're in pain, you can smile at it. So the sign of wisdom is the peace. That's why I always say the sign of insight is calm. The sign that you are getting very deep in meditation, that you're calm, is your ability to become wise. You measure the depth of your peace by the insights which come. You measure your insight by how peaceful you are. So this is actually when we talk about these sutras here. It's the senses disappear, but that only gives you the vision of Dharma. It shows you the data, but in the end, you know, the senses come back again after jhana. And even the Buddha could see, could hear, smell, taste, touch, could know. Once he sees that that's non-self, it's empty, it's just a flow of phenomena, then of course, that insight gained from that data will give you the release, the non-attachment. So that when somebody shouts at you, all it is vibrations of air just hitting the eardrum. That's all it is. Just vibrations, that's all. If somebody hits you, it's just feeling, that's all. If it's just pain, it's just bodily sensation. That's all it is. So why do we worry about it? It's only when we think it's my pain, it's my face recording, it's like a camel, it's my, when it's always my, that's called attachment, and that's where we lose the plot, as they say. We get attached, we're not at peace anymore. Even your mind, how many of you are at peace with your meditation, with your success or failure, whether you're in jhanas or not? It's not your mind. It's not your business to get into deep meditation. So leave it alone. Who gets into jhana anyway? Just process, that's all. So when it's not my mind, it's not my problem, then you stop striving. When you stop striving, then jhanas happen. So what are you trying to do? You're trying to get enlightenment. If you try to get enlightenment, there's this big I, me, which is blocking enlightenment happening. So you take that me out of the way. You take that I out of the way. You take that my out of the way. And then there's nothing between you, the jhanas, enlightenment, and everything. Understand? No, you don't. It's okay. Next question. That's over here. Ajahn. When we say, may I be well and happy, who is talking? Doer or knower? When you said that this morning, when we say, may I be well and happy, who is talking? I was talking. But then you say, Ajahn Brahm. Were you talking, or was Ajahn Brahm's non-self talking? And when I think, may I be well and happy, I know that was Ajahn Chah talking. And when Ajahn Chah was talking, was it Ajahn Chah talking? No, it was Ajahn Mun, his teacher, talking. When you trace it all back, where these ideas and thoughts come from, they all come from the Buddha. So actually, when you say, may I be well and happy, it literally is the Buddha talking. That's who said that. Not you, but the Buddha. Isn't that wonderful? It's not the doer, it's not the knower. The Buddha started all of this. When you pass the buck, who calls this? The buck stops with the guy behind me, the Buddha. It's wonderful. Why do you meditate? Because the Buddha told you to. He told his disciple, who told his disciple, who told his disciple. And that's been conditioned all the way down the line. And now you're sitting here. And you let go, you practice jhanas, you meditate. Why? Because 2,500 and so years ago, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, that's why. When you understand cause and effect, it's powerful. Amazing. 2, please elaborate how to note the space between the breath. Okay, if you can't do this yet, you can say, but take the 3 refuges inside. I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dhamma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. But say it slowly. I go for refuge to the Buddha. Pause. And listen what happens in the mind after you've said that, after you've thought that. And then you say, I go for refuge to the Dhamma. Pause. See the space between the refuges. Because you'll find when you say, I go for refuge to the Buddha, it's a powerful statement, and the mind actually goes towards where that signpost is pointing. The mind goes for refuge. In the same way, all words have power. Sometimes we don't listen to their echo, their resonance afterwards. For example, hate. Hate! Hate! What happened in your mind after I said that word? Actually, the mind started going towards hatred. It was a signpost for the mind, and the mind followed after that. Love. Listen after I finish the word. Love. Love. Can you see your mind going in that direction? That's why words have power. Sometimes that we stop We don't stop, sorry, after the word. We go on to the next word, so we never see where the signpost is leading. So, I go for refuge to the Buddha. Pause. And in that silence, you see the meaning. The silent meaning. I go for refuge to the Dhamma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. That's what we mean by silence. It's a feeling, a thing of the mind, which has no words. Like the signpost points to the town. When we get to the town, we don't need a signpost anymore. The words have done their job. The thought has finished, because we've got to where the thought was pointing. So try that. If you haven't managed to get silence yet, recite the three refuges to yourself. But pause between each refuge and listen. Listen with everything you've got to the beautiful silence which reverberates after you've gone for each refuge. Okay, that makes sense? Okay, next question. Te Ajahn, is mindfulness only present at present moments? Can it also exist in the past and future? Can you explain in samadhi how effort, mindfulness and concentration play their role in leading into deep concentration? Okay, really, if you are in the past, you're not really mindful of what's really happening now, are you? Sometimes people are like that, they're driving their car and they're thinking of the argument they just had with their wife and they go crash, bang, because they're not being mindful of the traffic. Some people sort of are mindful of the future, or they're not mindful, so they're thinking of the future. What's going to happen? There's only how many days to go? And you're thinking of all the things which are going to happen to you once you finish this retreat and all the business and stuff. You're not mindful of the present moment. Really, mindfulness, attentiveness, has to be on the present moment. That's why if you're in the past and the future, you're not really mindful, not in the Buddhist way. The Buddha also described mindfulness. He defined it as like memory, being able to remember things said and done a long time ago. That's one of the definitions. What's mindfulness to do with memory? I'll tell you. If you're really attentive to this moment, it registers in the mind. It's easy to remember. If you're off in the future and the past, you don't remember anything. Which is why that if you're learning sort of a course, if you're at a lecture, all you need to do is to make your mind very peaceful, attentive to the moment, and then it's very easy to remember what's been said and done. Recently, before I came on this trip to Singapore and Malaysia, we had a very great monk visiting our monastery for 7 days. It's Ajahn Plien from the north of Thailand. And when he gave a talk, he can understand English very well, but he can't speak English. So when he was giving a talk to the monks, someone had to translate, and that was me. I had to translate from Thai into English for him. However, that sometimes when you have a talk which is translated, the talker speaking in Thai really gets into his subject and starts getting some interesting dharma, and it doesn't stop until 15 minutes have gone. You've got a whole 15 minutes of information, he turns around to you, Bumawang, so translate. So you've got to translate a whole 15 minutes. How can you do that? It's very easy to do. All I need to do is when he's giving that talk, I listen. I don't try. If you're trying to remember, you're not listening. So just make your mind very still, very peaceful. Just allow the words to flow through. And when he's finished, he turns around, Bumawangsa, translate. Then the words just come back again. And just flow. And the monk sitting next to me, sort of, I was very tired at the time, I've always very busy. The monk sitting next to me, Ajahn Chattamala, he looked at me, that's amazing, how can you do that? So 50 minutes, he was listening as well. He said, I can't remember anything that you missed. So you can do that because your memory comes from samadhi, the peaceful application of sati. When sati, mindfulness, is focused in the moment, it lets go, never tries to... Actually, I did miss something on one of the sections there. And I knew I'd missed it as soon as it happened because he said something very interesting. And I saw my mind going out towards that interesting thing to grasp it. And I realized as soon as I did that, it's like pressing the delete button. And I lost a lot of what was happening before. And actually, you can actually see yourself doing that. When you actually listen to something, now if I said something very interesting and you grasp it, you've forgotten all the way before. That's how you have a great memory. You've got to listen absolutely passively and not go out anything. So as soon as you go out to capture it, you're not truly listening. That's that why samadhi, when it's attached or when it's alongside mindfulness, is very powerful. You get great memory. So, and how can you explain samadhi, effort and mindfulness and concentration play their role in leading into deep concentration? Okay, the mindfulness is a supervisor. Sees what you're doing. It's there in the moment, because where you're acting is now. The future, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. You can't stop acting in the future, because that's coming next. The past is already done. So mindfulness is wasting its time in the past. It's wasting its energy in the future. So mindfulness, the supervisor, is right now. Seeing what the workers are doing in this moment. Not worried about what they did a few moments ago or last week. That's finished, that's done. You're looking at the workers now. The supervisor. And the effort of the supervisor is just to make sure the workers don't slack off. They don't slack off into craving or attachment. So the supervisor has to make sure you're always doing the job. And the job is letting go. So the supervisor has to keep this beautiful freedom, peace, compassion, liberation, where you don't grasp, where you don't force, where you don't strive, you don't crave. Because it's always in the moment. If as long as you're striving and craving, you're off into the future somewhere. You're not really being present. You're not allowing the process to evolve. The supervisor just has to make sure that sun is warming the lotus. He doesn't have to do anything. Just has to make sure everything is going according to nature. The effort is the effort of a gardener. I don't know how many teachers have told me this. It's the effort of a gardener. The seed is planted. The rain provides the moisture. The sun provides the warmth. There's enough fertilizer in the soil. All a gardener needs to do is to protect it. To make sure that no hindrance, no craving comes to disturb the growth of the plant. So the effort is one of protection, nurturing. Not pulling the plants to stretch them. Not putting this fast fertilizer on it. I want the quick way to enlightenment. But allowing it to grow naturally, which is always the best. So that's the role of effort. And you can understand this because the Buddha did say the right effort is what arouses wholesome qualities and maintains them. Right effort is what abandons unwholesome qualities, keeps them away. So you know it by its results. If wholesome qualities are growing, such as peace, happiness, freedom, you know that was right effort. If unwholesome states of mind start to develop, headaches, tension, despondency, you know you've been doing wrong effort. And many of you have discovered, like I discovered a long time ago, that when you let go, when you relax, when you do loving kindness, peace, that's when the wholesome qualities grow. You feel it, the peace, the energy, the increased mindfulness, the love, the compassion. But when I strive, I get tense, I get grumpy, I get angry. When they're striving, unwholesome qualities grow. You don't believe me? Strive. Try and get enlightened. Try to get nimittas. You find the more you try, the worse it gets. The more the unwholesome qualities. It's craving, attachment, grasping. But when you relax and let go, you find, as many of you have in this retreat, the wholesome qualities have been increasing. That's why when people actually complain, Ajahn Brahm, you should get people to be more strict. And I said, you try, have a strict retreat, you'll watch more unwholesome qualities grow. People become tense. They even get sick. But you try this way, and you find most of the meditators, those who follow the instructions and stop their striving, they get all these beautiful, wholesome qualities. At last, they feel peace. They feel no stress. They feel happiness. They feel joy. The meditation gets deeper. They are more mindful. They're closer to Nibbana. And you can feel that. So you actually know what right effort is and what wrong effort is on this retreat. Every time you strive, what happens? Every time you really let go, what happens? Next question. Dear Van Ajahn, we aspire to attend the next Buddhist conference in Perth and also to stay at your monastery for a week or so. Can you please let us know the exact date? I think you know what I'm going to say about this, don't you? You might not live to that time. It's a long time in the future. It's something past tomorrow, and that's too far in the future for me. So, the exact date, there is no exact date. It's just fantasies and dreams. That's what the future is. The only time you have is now. So, forget about the conference. If your monastery is fully booked, can we bring sleeping bags and park ourselves along the corridors or in the garage? Thank you. Who knows what you can do? If you're very wise, and if you really follow the instructions on this retreat, your mind will be your monastery. The conference will come to you. You will always be in the global conference of peace and serenity. You'll be so enlightened, you won't need any conferences ever again. Wouldn't that be nice? The conferences are only for those people who don't know the Dhamma, who have want some more inspiration. Look, as a teacher, I'm trying to get rid of disciples. I've already got too many. I want to get rid of you all. It is true. I'm trying to get rid of each one of you. Just like any teacher in a school tries to get rid of their students. The teacher's whole aspiration is for you to graduate and to leave school. My aspiration, my wish, is for each one of you to get so deep into meditation, so enlightened, you never need to come and listen to any talk of mine ever again. Or of any other monk or nun. I am trying my hardest to get rid of you. I must be a terrible teacher because more of you keep coming every day. But anyway, imagine if I was a school teacher. If I was a school teacher, people kept on repeating my class year in, year out, year in, year out. I would be considered a terrible teacher. Okay, point made. In walking meditation, which pace achieves better results? Snail's pace, easy pace, or fast pacing? Okay, just any old pace will do. So you have nature pace. So whatever happens, that you just allow it to flow. There are some times when that you want to walk fast. Allow yourself to walk fast. Sometimes you want to walk so slowly. Allow yourself to walk slowly. Allow the feet to set the pace. And your mind just follows. The feet are the pacemakers. Your mind, it just follows on behind. Okay? So you don't set the pace. Let the feet set the pace. You just follow the feet. Is there any true stories where the previous life was ghost or animal, etc., other than human? Yeah, there's sometimes people have those experiences of being an animal before. There's this. Okay, I'll tell you this story. There, in one of the monasteries in Thailand, and one of the abbots of that monastery comes to visit us every now and again. Not Ajahn Plien, but another monk who visited. I think it was in October, just after the cotillion, early November, sorry. We know, like many monasteries in Thailand, that if you have any animals you don't want to look after, they've dumped them in the monastery. But in particular, that somebody found this poor monkey who had been kept. In a cage and treated very, very cruelly. So they brought, out of compassion, they brought this monkey from this villager and they sent it to the monastery so it could have a decent life. It's a forest monastery. So they set the monkey loose in the monastery. Obviously the monkey was very scared at first of its new people because it had never had any good experiences with humans. But because the monk was so kind and caring, because the abbot was such a great monk, soon the monkey became very tame. And especially the monkey was just so devoted to the abbot. He was so devoted to the abbot. He was a lovely little monkey, just, you know, very tame, very sort of fluffy and furry and cuddly. So sometimes there'd be people come from Bangkok to visit this monk. But if any of those people were cheeky, if ever they said something they shouldn't to a monk, this is what the monkey would do. He'd go into the first person and just allow that, sit on their lap and allow the person to pet it, to stroke the monkey, and the monkey would just be just so docile. It's lovely stroking a little nice monkey. And then he went to the second person, they would do the same, they'd stroke it, and it'd be so much fun. Then he'd go to the third, when he got to the person who was cheeky, he would sit in their lap and bite them. Just to tell them, this is the abbot, you should be more respectful. And he'd do that so often that eventually they had to send the monkey away because it was too dangerous. There's always a few cheeky disciples, even here. If I had a monkey, some of you might have got bitten by now. But anyhow, they took this monkey to this little nature reserve, which was an island, many, many acres, so it could be protected from hunters, where much wildlife lived. And this poor monkey got his deputy abbot, the second monk, to take him off to this island. And this poor monkey was just so depressed all the time. The monkey realized he'd done something wrong, and that he'd been exiled to this little island, so the poor monkey was just all depressed. When the second monk sort of dumped it on the island, the poor monkey looked back, so sad. He was missing his friends, the monks. After about a week or 10 days, the abbot, in his meditation, saw that monkey was so lonely and said, okay, he's been punished enough, go and get him back. So he sent the second monk over to collect the monkey. And according to the story, the second monk, just when he landed in the rowboat, on this island, couldn't see anybody, just shouted the name of the monkey. And within about 2 minutes, you could hear the trees sort of shaking. And this monkey came right towards them and jumped right into his arms. He was just so excited, ready to see a monkey again, one of his friends, and to go back. So he got straight into the boat again. The monk rowed over. On the way back, the monkey bit the second monk. Just actually to say, don't do that again. Don't leave me alone for such a long time. But it's just being a monkey, that's all. So he spent all the rest of his years in this monastery. And he became quite a character in the monastery because every time it was tea time for the monks, in those monasteries the monks would come together for tea time. And you'd always have to make a cup of tea for the monkey as well. He would not be left out. And just like all the monks were sitting there, the monkey would sit there cradling his cup of tea. Sipping it. It's just so sweet. He was associating so much with the kind monks that he could actually see what his future birth would be. Because when you associate that much and almost you think you're a human being, you become a human being. And one of the things he used to do, he was very, very protective of the monastery. If there was any loud noise, he would try and stop it. In particular, any cars or trucks which raced past the monastery, he'd try and trace them away to try and keep the monastery quiet and secluded for his friends, the monks. But one day, he chased a truck and got run over and died. That's how he died. But the abbot was in meditation at the time. And he saw the stream of consciousness leave the dead monkey and go off into the village. It's a quick rebirth because one of the women in the village was pregnant. And he saw that monkey just go into the woman's womb. He knew it had got a human birth. And when that woman gave birth, this is true, that little baby was exceptionally hairy. That was many years ago. I haven't been back to that monastery for quite a while now. But when that baby grows up and goes to school, everybody knows that story. He's going to have a hard time in school. He'll say, you were a little monkey before. And you're a little monkey now too. He's a human being now, but it was a monkey in its past life, and everybody knows. So yeah, you can get reborn that way, but if it's a human, if it's an animal, especially a pet, that's very, very close to human beings, and it's got enough good karma, because of its association, it almost identifies with being a human, and that's the birth it will take. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, I was wondering if you could tell me why the Buddha had hair, but all other monks have to shave their hair. I was just curious to know. Many thanks. Yeah, okay. Now, the real Buddha never had hair. But what actually happens is just the statues and the conventions and the traditions we have. It's just the first statues were made by the Greek Indians. Because no matter what some of the commentaries say, there was no tradition of statues in India, not of human beings. Maybe of animals, but not humans. So the first statues, they say, were made in Gandhara, now present-day Afghanistan, where the Greeks who came with Alexander set up little kingdoms, and with it brought their culture statues. And that knowing that the Buddha was a royal person, they actually, the back of the head was supposed to be a turban at first. And apparently, I've never seen this, they say the first Buddha statues had beards, because all Greeks had beards. They thought that the Buddha was just like them. They cast the image in their own way. So later on, obviously, they realized the Buddha didn't have any of those things. But there was still this, one of the sutras, which is quite late, came after the time of the Buddha, where you have the marks of a Buddha. They say in there he's got a little bump on the back of the head. And that his hair, once it was cut, only needed to be cut once, and as soon as it was cut, went into little curls. That's more like an African's hair than an Indian's hair. It was very strange. But the point was that became a tradition. However, as many monks have said, if you look actually in the original teachings, the original stories in the time of the Buddha, the earliest strand of Buddhism, you see there were so many occasions when people could not recognize the Buddha. Where he was walking along the road, and other people came across, he just looked like another monk. And that, to me, and to many other people, shows the Buddha was indistinguishable from anybody else. That he too had a bald head. There's one case where this monk was traveling to see the Buddha, and the Buddha, out of compassion, traveled to see him. So they met in this little shed. I think it was a potter's shed, And I think the other monk got there first. So when the Buddha came, he said, "Monk, if it's not inconvenient for you, can I also stay here?" He said, "Yeah, sure." And then this monk, the visiting monk, in the evening, started meditating. And the Buddha started meditating. And the monk opened his eyes, and this visitor, who was a Buddha, he didn't know it was a Buddha, was also meditating and sitting so straight. So he meditated. So both of them meditated all night. And in the early morning, sort of when they came out of meditation, this monk said to the Buddha, he didn't know it was a Buddha, he said, "Monk, you sit very straight. Who's your teacher?" He said, "I've got no teacher. Who's your teacher?" "Oh, my teacher's the Buddha." "What do you mean you've got no teacher? Everyone should have a teacher." He said, "I am the Buddha." Ah! And this monk sort of bowed down and asked forgiveness. "Oh, sorry, if you'd only let me know that you were the Buddha, I would have bowed and I've asked all these questions." Because he never realized. He meditated all night, never realized he was in the presence of a Buddha. There's many stories like that. even at the end of the Buddha's life, when King Ajatasattu came to visit him in the bamboo grove. King Ajatasattu saw all these monks and had to ask, which one is the Buddha? He said, the one on that pillar facing east. So there's many of those accounts show that the Buddha was indistinguishable from other beings, from other monks, as far as his physical form was concerned. However, now that sometimes, for example, when we had our first Buddha statue made for our monastery, we said, well, let's get back to the original tradition. Let's make it without this bump on the head, a bald head. And the artist in Thailand said, no, we can't do that, because in art, the little bump on the head and the little snail-like hair things, he said, that actually shows it is the Buddha, not an ordinary monk. So that's actually the sign. It's like having a sign underneath, this is the Buddha. And that's actually how you know, because sometimes people find these old statues, they don't know whether it's a statue of a monk, a statue of a king, or a statue of the Buddha. So we've kept this now, a little bump on the head, a little hair on there. It doesn't mean that the Buddha looked like that. It just means that this is a sign that this statue represents the Buddha. Okay? Next question here. During meditation, when a stable nimitta appears or in jhana, the five senses disappear, meaning breathing has ceased. In medical physical condition, you are dead. My apology for a stupid question. It's no question is stupid. People who don't ask questions are stupid. Everyone who asks a question is doing the karmic causes for being wise. When a stable nimitta appears, the five senses are not really disappeared yet. They're still sort of potentially there. Sometimes when a nimitta appears, you can still hear sounds, but in the distance, feel the body, but it's not really central to your field of attention. As the nimitta really gets brighter and more stable, those sounds are just so far away you can't hear them. The feelings are so distant you can't feel them. As the nimitta stabilizes and grows in intensity, the five senses get less and less and less and less until they turn off. In a jhana, they've turned off. That's why the jhanas are described as vivicheva kamehi. Kama, K-long-A-M-A, literally means the five senses. Like karma loka, the world of the five senses. When those five senses are abandoned, that is jhana. That's one of the signs of jhana. So that in a jhana there's no sense activity at all with the five senses. However, you are still breathing, you just don't know it, that's all. It's only in the fourth jhana that breathing absolutely stops. So, if you get into first, second or third jhana, someone looks at you, so light is your breath, maybe they might not see it, but you are still breathing. The fourth jhana you're not. So, in a physical condition, medical condition, the fourth jhana, it looks like you're dead. But you ain't. So you're still there. It's just similar to being dead. How do you know your teacher is teaching the right thing or not? Thank you. How you know is to try it out. But don't believe, don't be gullible. So, what your teacher says, does it make sense? Is it reasonable? Is it rational? Does it accord with your experience? Number one. Number two, does it accord with the teachings in the original teachings of the Buddha? Check that out. Does it lead to peace, harmony, freedom? Check that one out as well. So you can actually see, does it make sense? Is it accordance with the original teachings of the Buddha? Number three, does it actually lead to peace and harmony, freedom? Those are the three things you can use to test out if what your teacher is saying is true or not. Also, just check out the character of the teacher. Because if the teacher is teaching these things and he can't do it himself or herself, then you can actually doubt the teachings. If they can't do it, what right have they to tell other people to do these things? So check out the virtue, meditation and wisdom of the teacher. So then you can actually know if what the teacher is saying is true. So I've got four things there. Number one, to make sure it's reasonable, rational, according to your experience. Number two, that it leads to peaceful states of mind. Number three, it's in accord with the original teachings of the Buddha. And the last one, number four, that so the teacher's practicing what he teaches. Recently, when I was in Singapore, I had a free morning, and it was the Buddhist Library was doing a little charity walk. And I thought, oh, it's about time I helped them out. So, without them really knowing, I got in the car and I joined their charity walk. And at the start of the charity walk, so they never expected me, here's Ajahn Brahm, so they invited me to give a little talk. I was sitting at the table, there was one of the ministers there, I forget which minister it was, called Boon Wan or something, I haven't got his name correctly, one of the ministers, the Buddhist ministers of Singapore. And then I asked him, while I was sitting there just having a cup of tea before the ceremony started, I said, are you going to do the walk? He said, no, all I'm going to do is to give a talk, because I have got another business. So, you're not someone who walks the talk, you're someone who talks the walk. And he laughed, and he mentioned that in his speech. He said, I'm a minister who talks the walk, but I don't walk the talk. Because as soon as he finished talking, he went off. So, if you are a real teacher, you will actually practice what you teach. So if you see anyone saying, be compassionate, be kind, they sit up here, and they tell you off, what sort of teacher is that? If they're cruel to you, then they should not teach compassion. Then imagine, is it appropriate for a monk and a nun to have their meals together in a closed room with no one else with them? Can a woman enter a monk's room when he is around? Thank you with metta. Okay, if a monk and a nun are alone together, even if they're both arahats, who knows? Tongues will wag. Because who knows what they do alone together? Now, this is a trouble here. It's not that you have to be pure. You have to be seen to be pure. And that's most important. Because look, one of the things my father said when I was young, it was one of his jokes. He used to say, what fun does a monk have? He said, the answer is none. Get it? Because in culture, people think the monks and nuns play around together, and some of them actually do. So even if you might be a really good monk, a really good nun, for the sake of both of your reputations, to stop people wagging their tongues, to stop the suspicions of the malicious, that we always have a man present. Or in the nuns' monastery, if they're alone with a man, they have another woman present to keep it even. So it protects everybody's reputation. Because you know just how people like to gossip. You know how to people, you know, sometimes they think, Ajahn Brahm, what does he do? He's all right when he's up here, but what does he do in his room? Has he got any magazines under the bed? Which is why I tell people that you can actually go into my room at Serpentine every time you like and have a look and see what's under the bed or anywhere. You can actually look in all the drawers and find out how I live. I've got nothing to hide at all. So the point is, this is why it's good to have the separation there. And it's also good because not all monks are arahats, not all nuns are enlightened. And sometimes it's association. If you get a young monk, you get a young nun, they may start off with just not talking Dharma together. But you know, hormones are hormones. Nature is nature. And after a while, you know, the Dharma talks to other things, goes to other things. You like each other, and after you like each other, you get romance, fantasies, and sure enough, there's an engagement ring next. And then a wedding ring and supper ring coming afterwards. So you've got to protect your monks and nuns, especially the young ones. Because if ever you've tried to be a monk or a nun, you know how hard it sometimes is. So protect them. So that's why it's good for monks and nuns to be slightly separate. If there's lots of people around, for example, sometimes we go to these house dharmas, then it's okay for the monks and nuns, as I did the other day at Dr. Ang Beng Chu's house in Singapore. There's about two or three monks on one side of the table, a couple of nuns on the other side of the table. But it was in her house, lots of other people around. Nothing wrong with that at all. And can a woman enter a monk's room when he is around as long as many of other people are around as well? But if a woman sneaks into my room at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock afterwards, even if she's only there to sweep the room, you'd think, what did I see? I saw a woman go into Ajahn Brahm's room. So of course you don't want to do that. Because you don't know what goes on. Even it might be the best reasons. That's why, please, all the women, it's not that I'm uncompassionate to women. It's not that Buddha was sexist. Please, all the women, it's not that I'm uncompassionate to women. It's not that Buddha was sexist. When it's celibacy, you have to have some separation between the genders. And it's actually absolutely even with the nuns as well. In Perth, the nuns have the same rules with regard to the monks. The men, sorry. No men is allowed into those women's rooms alone. For their benefit as well. Okay. Next question. Here we go. Actually, there's an interesting story. One of my friends, he was a monk in the United States. And he was giving talks like this, and many people got inspired by him. And this woman came up to him afterwards and said, "I'm just so inspired by you. I want to be your guppy-a. To go for the rest of your life. I'll have to go around with you, just actually to carry your bags. If any donations, I'll look after them for you. You know, to help you wash your robes, everything else. I just want to be your attendant." And he had to say, "Now listen, sort of, you know, you've got a very good mind. It's very compassionate and noble of you. But, you know, if you go around with me wherever I go, that people will think that, you know, there's some romance there. It's against our rules because we'll have to be alone together. Even though, you know, your ideas are compassionate and pure, my mind is pure, but people won't understand. So I'm sorry, you can't do that." And she was so disappointed. So she went away, and about a month later, she gave him a call. He was in some other city. He said, "It's me again. It's all sorted out. I can be your guppier now." "What do you mean?" he said. "Look, I told you, you know, you can't have a girl being a guppier to a monk. I'm having my sex change next week." "Ah, no, you can't. Stop it." She'd already booked her sex operations so she could be a man, so she could be a guppier for this monk. "You must admire her devotion, but her wisdom is lacking." True story. Crazy. How do we send merit if we only did a poor meditation? There's no such thing as a poor meditation. Every meditation is a good meditation. The very fact you sit on your seat and you aspire for peace, that is huge merit. So don't be so demanding and think you have to get into jhana before you've got a good meditation. Every meditation is a good meditation. It is as if that you are going to work. This is the simile of going to work. You go to work on a Monday. You don't get any money for that. You work so hard, you get nothing from going to work. It's a bad day. Second day, Tuesday, you go to work, you still don't get anything. Wednesday and Thursday are the same. By Thursday evening, you're losing hope. "I worked so hard for this company, and what have I got out of it? Nothing." On Friday, maybe you don't work even as hard as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but on Friday, the boss gives you the paycheck. Why can't every day be like a Friday? And of course you understand that you're getting paid not just for Friday, but for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday as well. It's the same with somebody, they're sitting here and they press the right buttons, they get so peaceful, so calm and so happy, at last I can do it. And you wonder why the next time you meditate you can't get deep meditation. Why you can't get a paycheck when you meditate. After a while, you get the understanding. You get the paycheck, you get the beautiful meditation, not just because what you've done since you put your bottom on the chair this time. You're getting paid for all those so-called bad meditations as well. When you never got a paycheck, but you were aspiring for peace, you were learning, gaining insight, aspiring to letting go. All those times you thought were bad meditations, your credit is all building up. And when you have what you call a good meditation, it's not because you've done it right for a change. All the accumulated good karma is now so strong, you get your paycheck. And for those of you who haven't got a good meditation yet, I assure you, the check is in the mail. It's coming! There's no such thing as a bad meditation. You're just building up steam. So keep up, keep on sitting, the check is in the mail. So that's why there's no such thing as a bad meditation. That's why you can always send merit. Even if you haven't got the paycheck yet, you can always send merit. It's an IOU. When you get your paycheck, then it's sort of taken off your account. So you can do credit. You can share merit for stuff you haven't earned yet. Just like you can buy a house or you can buy a car with money which is not in your bank yet. You get a loan, credit. Merit, credit. Did Buddha really reincarnate 500 lifetimes in order to become a Buddha? Is past lives playing an important role in our spiritual cultivation? The Buddha lived innumerable lives. It's not 500. Innumerable lives. See, as each one of you as well, how many times have you been reborn? You know one of my favorite stories about people who speak when they're born? There's two or three cases I know of little babies come out of the womb and have been able to speak immediately. Thing is, they speak with an adult voice, not a baby voice. And my favorite case was in a San Francisco hospital. In front of the doctors and the midwives, the baby came out of the womb and immediately spoke. What it said was, "Oh no, not again." Oh no, not again. Here we go, nappies again. This little dummy, the pacifier, they shove in my mouth. I've got to go to school all over again. You've got to do all your exams all over again. Oh my goodness. Do you want to be in nappies again? Do you want to be pushed around in a pram? Patted on the back to try and get rid of your colic? Wetting your pants? Do you really want to do that again? Be careful if you don't. And rebirth? Oh no, not again. So, many, many lives. So past lives, they do play a role in your spiritual cultivation, but the most important of your lives is this one. Now is the most important time. You've got heaps of good karma. You've got heaps of bad karma as well. But your heaps of good karma, just play with that. Leave the bad karma alone. So always remember, when you go to the shed to pick up your good karma or your bad karma, the eggs or the chicken shit, always pick up the eggs. Leave the chicken shit in the shed. Leave your bad karma in the past. Just collect the good karma. Just like Angulimala. In Mahayana, it believes the Bodhisattva coming back to samsara by their vow to help the sufferers. But if a person attains jhana, he's cut off from samsara. Is there a contradiction between the two? You're not cut off from samsara by the jhanas, but by the insights which come from the jhanas. There you realize that you're on the way out. So the Bodhisattva is just an attitude of mind to help. The Arahat is the attitude of mind to liberate yourself so you can help. You become an Arahat so you can be a Bodhisattva. You're a Bodhisattva so you can be an Arahat. The two come together. But as far as being reincarnated, if you die, the Arahat dies. Does that mean the teachings are lost in the world? Of course they're not. Just as the Dhamma is still here, that the echo of the Buddha still reverberating down the centuries. So even when an Arahat dies, the echo of the Dhamma still lives after them. So you don't need to keep coming back. In fact, the human being, the five khandhas, don't come back for the Arahat, but the Dhamma still keeps coming back. The Buddha doesn't get reincarnated, but the Dhamma does. Do you understand? So the Bodhisattva is not the person which keeps coming back. It's the teaching, the truth. That keeps coming back. So the person just gets extinguished, disappears. The Buddha is gone. That's why it's called a Tathagata. Thus gone. Gone. So that the Buddha disappeared. And the Buddha is supposed to be the great Bodhisattva. So sometimes people, the Buddha said this was his last life, never comes back again, but he's supposed to be a Bodhisattva. Isn't that a contradiction? Because if the Buddha was a Bodhisattva, shouldn't the Buddha come back again for another life? But he said this is his last life. What did he mean? It means the Buddha, the vehicle of the Dhamma, the five khandhas called Siddhartha Gautama, that's disappeared. But that's not the important part. That's not the essence. The Dhamma, that keeps reincarnating every time. Every time there's an arahat, the bodhisattva of Dhamma is reincarnated into this world. It's the Dhamma which is reincarnates, not the person. That's why you become a Buddha and the Dhamma never disappears. You can become enlightened. Become enlightened. The Dhamma is the bodhisattva, not the person. That's why the person disappears. But the Dhamma keeps on being reborn for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. So do you understand? Now there's no difference. The Eightfold Path, Sila Samadhi Panya. Look at it one way. The bodhisattva is the essential teachings which keep going on. You realize those essential teachings and those essential teachings keep reoccurring in the world. The arahat, the five khandhas cease without remainder. Okay? Very good. I like bringing traditions together. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between love, compassion and devotion? How would each of the above lead to positive attachment and negative attachment? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, there's love, which is personal satisfaction. What I want out of somebody else. I think you've heard me say the acid test, the difference between love and loving kindness. Do you really love your partner? Your husband, your wife, even your boyfriend. Do you really love them? Or are you attached to them? Is it loving kindness, the door of my heart is open to you no matter what you ever do? Is it their happiness the most important thing in your life? Sometimes when we fall in love, we think that's what love is. You find your partner in life, I just want you to be happy. I devote my life to your happiness. I just want you to be well, happy. My love is selfless for you. However, imagine your partner. Now, they may not be with you on this retreat. Imagine that you're on this retreat, they're at home. And on Sunday afternoon, when you go back, you find in your apartment, in your house, there's a note on the front door from your partner. The note says they've run away to Perth or to New York. That's somewhere more romantic. They've run away with your best friend to have sex, to get married. How would you feel? Would you feel, they can't do that to me, they're being unfaithful? If that's how you feel, it is a selfish love. If you feel, isn't that wonderful, they're more happy with my best friend than they are with me. I'm so happy they're having a good time. Isn't it wonderful, I'm so ecstatic that they are even more happy than they were before. Because if it's real love, isn't it the door my heart's open to you no matter what you ever do? Isn't their happiness the most important thing? Don't you want to serve and make them as happy as possible? If they're getting even more happy with your best friend than they are with you, why aren't you happy? That's what I call the acid test of love. Do you really love you, or do you love them? And of course, I think you'll all agree that you love yourself more than they do up there. How can they do this to me? So, look what love is and what compassion is. If it's compassion, it frees. If it's love, it's attachment. It puts people in a prison. If you love, you know, your possessions, if you love your children, if you love your partner, you put them in a prison. You love them as long as they're around. You love them as long as they live up to your expectations. You're putting them in prison. If it's real compassion, loving kindness, you free them. Children, wherever you are, you can go over to the other side of the earth. I'll always love you, I'll always care for you, no matter where you go, no matter what you do. I don't demand anything at all. My love frees you. Dear husband, dear wife, if you want to go off into the retreat, I love you enough to free you. Dear husband, dear wife, if you want to become a monk or a nun, your happiness is my happiness. I free you. Dear husband, dear wife, dear parent, if it's time for you to die, I will miss you, but I love you enough to let you go. Go with my blessing. Be free. Now do you understand the difference between real love and selfish attached love? Next question. I'm not going to get through them. My goodness. Is there a difference between rebirth and reincarnation? No. Attention, abortion is a sinful act. How can I help someone who went through this and help the being who are being aborted? Thank you so much. Abortion is killing, but sometimes killing small things, killing big things is very different. And it's much less bad karma if it's a small being in the womb. Sometimes it's not killing, because sometimes if the stream of consciousness hasn't entered the womb yet, the natural being in there is no different than a part of the woman. It's just like cutting a growth out, like a cancer. However, if the stream of consciousness has come from another life and has come into that little fetus, then that is a separate being, and that is killing. Unfortunately, we can't really tell the difference unless you've got psychic powers. However, a sinful act is so difficult actually to understand exactly what's going on there. There's all sorts of other circumstances which do need to be taken into consideration, and a woman has to balance that. And the thing is that if a person has made a calm decision, they think it's compassion, and they decided to have an abortion, then your job is to support them to love the woman. Don't just think of the baby. Think of the woman, the mother's had to do such a thing. So be kind, caring. Forgive. There's no punishment in Buddhism. No 50 strokes of the cat. I mean, there's 50 strokes of the cat, but learning compassion, nothing else. So this is how you help the being, to come to peace with this, to learn from it, acknowledge it, and to let it go. Look, Anguli Mala didn't actually commit abortions. He killed real people, heaps of them. And he could forgive himself and let go. The Buddha would forgive him. So take the example of Anguli Mala. He managed to forgive himself. If a woman has committed an abortion, forgive yourself quickly. You can still become enlightened. You can be at peace and be a loving one. It's a difficult decision to make. And I, as a monk, as a man, have got no right to make that decision for a woman. Nor have I the right to tell her it's wrong. Steve Anarjan, and the Buddhist community, which comprises mainly the Chinese population, is dwindling according to the national statistics. This is due to those who remain single, have lesser children, migrate to Western countries, convert to other religions, become monks and nuns. Very soon there won't be enough lay people to support the Sangha. It's still thank you with metta. The national statistics which I have seen, I haven't seen the ones in Malaysia, but I know the ones in Singapore, the Buddhism is the fastest growing religion in Singapore. I think in the last census, which I got a copy of, interestingly enough, in Penang, it was in the Penang newspaper once, somebody cut it out and I kept it with me, I think the Buddhists, actually they almost went up by 60 or 70%. From the last census to the previous one. The point is that sometimes there are some members of society who actually do not quote the statistics, quote their own ideas, and say, oh, this is the fastest growing religion, or that's the fastest growing religion. Buddhism, in most countries of the world, is the fastest growing religion. I saw in a newspaper the other day, they said, oh, Islam was the fastest growing religion in Australia. That is a lie. It's not true. Buddhism is the fastest growing religion in Australia. And this is not by migrants. This is like Australians becoming Buddhists. A few years ago, I was teaching a youth group here in KL. I was in PJ. And it was a group of like teenagers. And I said, what's the fastest growing religion in the West? And they all said straight away, Christianity. So where did you hear that from? They said, the Christians. Look in the internet, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, you'll find that Buddhism is for the last two censuses, being the fastest growing religion. But of course, it's not in the interest of some groups to announce that and to say that. So I'm not sure what the actual real statistics are, but have a look to see what it is. You'll probably find that Buddhism is still the fastest growing. It's still very, very strong. Look how many temples are going up. Look how full those temples are. So they're not declining. Sometimes I wish it would decline so I could have an easier life. But certainly I'm busy enough, so it must be growing. So remain single, have lesser children, migrate to Western countries, convert to other religions, become monks and nuns. How many people do you know have become monks and nuns? Just such a small amount. Just a drop in the ocean. So that's not going to affect the number of people having kids. So that more and more people are becoming Buddhists, and it's very clear to me it's the future religion of our world. All the other religions end up fighting each other. The Buddhists are always the pacifists, the ones who create tolerance and peace in this world. And it's the ones which is true to science. I was a scientist before I became a monk. And the very fact that some religions can actually say that the world was created 5,000 years ago is absolutely ridiculous. And how are they going to get away with that when there's so much mountain of evidence to say this world, this universe is far older than 5,000 years. Adam and Eve weren't the first people in this world. It can't be. It's proven not to be. However, that people, they won't go on the evidence, they go on their beliefs. However, those beliefs, if they're not founded on truth, they can't last. People do ask questions. The evidence is out there. Because the evidence is out there, that some of these ideas, they just cannot last. And the idea that the Christian Bible is the Word of God, history shows that that Bible has changed many, many times. You've got like the first Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, read that, it's very different than the Bible they go around today. Which one was the Word of God? Or does the Word of God keep changing? So the whole of the thing, that it's illogical, irrational. And eventually, you cannot stop people finding out the truth. And because of that, because Buddhism is open, does allow questions, does allow people to go to any other religion they want to and check it out. Because Buddhism has nothing to fear. Other paths, other religions have a lot to fear. That's why they say, don't go read other books. Don't go around with other religions. Only stay amongst our fold. It's called a cult. That's why it's declining. As intelligence, as knowledge grows, any false teachings have to disappear. So, no worries. You are backing the right horse. Dear Ajahn, to know or to know the steps or to know the breath in and out, isn't it itself a form of thinking? How do we go about stopping the thinking, e.g. metta, bhavana, visualization? Okay, you stop the thinking, not just all in one go, stopping all thought, bang, stop, because you won't be able to do that. So you stop it in stages. Instead of thinking about anything and everything, you focus your thoughts. You just think on one line, just like loving kindness, loving kindness, loving kindness. Or you just think noting, noting, noting. Or you just think counting the breath, breathing in one, breathing out one. Or you think buddho, 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 buddho. So instead of actually stopping all thought, you just stop most of thought and you just keep a little bit of thought left. Like a halfway house. And when you go from thinking about everything to directed thought, then soon you can let go of that last remnant of thought, directed thought, and have no thought at all. That's why we do allow a little bit of thought, but not all thought. You're doing loving kindness, you're just thinking about metta. You're doing reflection on the Buddha, you're just thinking about Buddha. You're doing counting, you're just thinking about the breath, counting. You're just washing your feet, walking, meditating, just lifting, going forward, whatever. So your thinking is confined. And after a while, because it's confined, the thinking can then go to the next step and be left behind completely. Going down the gears of your car, fourth gear, then third gear, second gear, first gear, and then you can stop. And I always develop a pressure clamp on the forehead when the thinking process occurs during meditation. How to solve? Okay, because you've tried to relax already, try reverse psychology. Try and screw up your forehead as strong as you can. Get it really tight. Tighter than you've ever had before. Screw it up really tight. Then let it go. The thing is, when you really let it go, it's really tight, and then you let it go, it tends to relax further than you were before. It's like sometimes you've got an ache in your shoulders. Instead of trying to relax it, screw it up really tight, scrunch it up, tight as a ball, and then let it go. And it sort of relaxes, it falls to a state of relaxation which was lower than when you started. Sometimes you can use that technique. Otherwise, just forget about it. Say, forehead, I allow you to cramp and have pressure. Go for it. So you're not fighting. Because you're not fighting, because you're not adding fuel to the fire, you're not controlling, you'll find quite naturally it will loosen up. If you're afraid of it, if you're worried about it, if it's a problem, it gets tighter and tighter and tighter. If you just relax, okay, that's fine. It's just like a pain in the body. When you allow it to be, it disappears. I don't want this pain. Why me? I don't want to hurt. And it gets worse and worse and worse. Just like the questions. Oh, look at this next question here. Where do you draw the line between illicit sex and non-illicit sex? That's coming tomorrow. So I'll answer that question tomorrow. Okay, enjoy the afternoon, morning. Nice meditation. See you later.